You're listening to DVD Talk Radio.
Ladies and gentlemen, this picture, truly one of the most unusual ever filmed, contains scenes which under no circumstances should be viewed by anyone with a heart condition or anyone who is easily upset. We urgently recommend that if you are such a person or the parent of a young or impressionable child now in attendance, that you and the child leave the auditorium.
That's music to a gorehound's ears, isn't it? Greetings, Cineschlockers. This is DVD Talk columnist Noel Gross, and I'm just back from the Chiller Theater Expo, where they paid tribute to the Blood Trilogy. Yes, the 40th anniversary of three films that changed horror cinema forever. The first film, of course, being the 1963 classic Blood Feast, starring Connie Mason and Mal Arnold, who were both on hand, along with the great godfather of gore himself, Herschel Gordon Lewis, and his partner in gore, David F. Friedman. What you're about to hear is their Q&A with fans there at Chiller Theater, and I hope you'll enjoy it.
As everybody knows, Blood Feast established almost, really inadvertently, a totally new category of motion picture, one that didn't exist before we made that picture. At the time we made that movie, the four of us really were outlaws in the movie business. How dare you make a movie like that? Which was funny, because at the time, there was a lot of regulation against nudity. There wasn't one nude frame in Blood Feast. There was regulation against obscenity. There was not one four-letter word in Blood Feast. There was no regulation against gore because nobody had ever done it. We, in fact, temporarily established new rules for censorship. And we fought a battle we had never intended to fight, because at that time, what our intention was to make a specialty picture for a specialty kind of audience to play in specialty kinds of theaters. And the rules of time have been very kind to all of us, because now what was regarded as outrageous and maybe even borderline illegal has become mainstream. All it takes really for that to happen is for the major companies to say, as they did, how long has this been going on? We better do the same thing. And suddenly the outlaws become the in-laws. So that's the genesis of the whole gore film, now called splatter film, industry. And as you can see, because you're here and we are here, it has become an industry. And one of the elements that I think we have proved is that entertainment trumps budget. Because our intention was to deliver a new kind of entertainment. And when I see some of the, I'll call it product, and that's being generous, being excreted today by some of the companies that are spending at least 1,000 times what we spent on our most expensive picture. And these pictures are exhibited for a couple of weeks and then vanish forever. And you can go into one of the videotape stores or the DVDs, and they will have some, maybe, but certainly within a year, they are banished into oblivion. And here are films that, for one reason or another, and we all have our individual theories as to the why of it, have not banished into oblivion, and are not about to. And I can tell you right now that people two or three generations from now will be admiring Connie Mason's beauty the way they have for the last two generations. They will be admiring Mal Arnold's eyebrows the way they have been. They will be admiring Dave Friedman's showmanship the way they have been. And my personal admiration is for two people, one of whom's in the doorway, Jimmy Maslin. He's the guy who saved these pictures from oblivion. And he deserves a hand of applause.
Yeah.
And the other one is Mike Braney, the owner of Something Weird Video, who is truly, aside from anything else, he's completely atypical of people in this business in that he is honorable. And I swore that I would probably go through my life and maybe several lifetimes beyond and never meet anybody in that business who was honorable. And I met one. And to my total astonishment, I'm involved in business with this fellow and he is still honorable. So miracles do happen in the movie business. Somebody else talk.
I'd just like to say thank you for pushing the lines and the limits of making the craft and everything that you have done. Because if it wasn't for you, other people wouldn't have the freedom to express themselves through the movies and all, and horror as one.
That's very kind of you. We did push the envelope, didn't we? Well, we had guts. And in fact, some of the times when we were fighting the battle with newspapers that wouldn't take our ads, the question was whether it was worth the battle. And obviously that you asked that question so kindly, so generously, and so thoughtfully, that really does help make it worthwhile. I recall, I think it was in Louisville, Kentucky, the Louisville Courier Journal, I think was the newspaper, would not, they had suddenly an edict, they wouldn't take a title with the word blood in it. Well, at that time, out came this movie, this Truman Capote story with Robert Blake, the strange person, called In Cold Blood. And see, he was trapped like a dolphin in a tuna net because they didn't dare single out Blood Feast. But there were some places we had opened under the title Flesh Feast. Those days are gone. And one other area, of course, that's open today is video and cable and satellite and things we never had. When we made Blood Feast, we were either going to succeed in the theaters or not at all, because that was the venue, that was the avenue, that was the only place to go. And we had to satisfy not just the people who might come into the theater, but the theater owners themselves to book this picture in the teeth of what they might get in the way of civic ire as they showed the picture. So yeah, we've come a long way, baby. And whether it's credit or responsibility or damnation, we did it.
Can you tell us how you came up with the campaigns for Blood Feast, 2000 Maniacs? And
well, it almost wrote itself. Ursula and I both kick around a lot of words. And of course, out of some of our conversation came a great four-letter word, gore, G-O-R-E. And Herschel's quite a somaticist. He has a wonderful vocabulary. And so out of the kicking around copy, nothing in the annals of horror to compare. There was one word I always loved, nubile. Nubile girls, the victims of this monster, etc., etc. At one point, I think I wrote on the one sheet, nubile young girls. Herschel had to point out that I thought nubile had a kind of a nasty sound, but Herschel pointed out nubile only means young, but so nubile young became redundant, but it wound up in the one sheet anyway. But the picture kind of, the copy wrote itself for Blood Feast. The art was easy enough. We certainly had enough photos and what have you, and it just worked. It was a point that no one had ever seen anything like it, and that's... As I say, in the exploitation business, you do one thing. You sell the sizzle, not the steak. So the campaign was, excuse me, Herschel, the campaigns were better than the pitch.
I don't find that the least bit insulting. Yes, sir.
Are there any challenges you ran into from a production standpoint during the making of Blood Feast?
Well, sure there were, because today you can go in any magic store and you can get a rubberized arm that the hand goes like this, and what we would have given for that instead of using department store mannequins. In fact, cheap department store mannequins. The challenge we ran into was to having the gore look like gore. Now, what we did, because Dave and I had been involved in an earlier little black and white movie called Living Venus, there's a scene in Living Venus which is the rise and fall of someone loosely patterned on Hugh Hefner. where somebody takes a swipe at him and the blood trickles out, and we had stage blood. But we looked at it and we realized it was far too purple for what we wanted for Blood Feast. So down we went to a little cosmetics laboratory in Coral Gables, Florida, and they compounded our stage blood, which looked more like blood than blood. If you got a transfusion, you would say, gee, thank you, until you died quickly. the major chemical in there was kaopectate. We didn't tell the actresses that, because some of them had to take it orally. But anyway, that was the last thing we'd shoot with them anyhow.
Well, getting back to the campaign for just a minute, it was the old circus carnival ballyhoo. We had a screening. We finished the picture, and Herschel and I screened the picture. We didn't invite anybody else, except my wife came along. It was a little dark screening room down on Wabash Avenue in Chicago. And I don't even think Kohlberg was there. Just the three of us, and maybe one of the operator. I think he was throwing up while he watched the picture.
That still happens.
On the way home, my wife is a school teacher type and isn't into exploitation, although she put up with me in the carnival business, in the birth of a baby business. She put up with me through an awful lot. But on the way home, I said, honey, how'd you like the picture? And she said, in one word, I said, yes. She said, vomitous. So the next morning, I ordered a half a million vomit bags. The same way, you may need this when you see Blood Feast. And that was part of the joy of going out exploiting Blood Feast. You did it like the advance man for a carnival or a circus. If you remember, Herschel, that terrible review we got in the Miami Herald.
Couldn't have been better.
We had. And this guy said, this picture looks like a 16 millimeter home movie. And we wrote him and said, no, this is a 35 millimeter home movie. So we never bothered about bad reviews. As a matter of fact, sometimes I think a bad review, you could put sprocket holes on it and run it through the machines, you'd do business with it. Perfect example of that, Kevin Thomas on the Los Angeles Times. He said, Blood Feast is a blot on the American film industry. It is amateur, yak. The picture opened in Los Angeles in about 35 spots and went through the roof. I mean, it was fantastic. 2 years later, almost to the day, Kevin Thomas reviewed a picture I had made called She Freak. And he said, She Freak is a surprisingly good little picture that was made by a couple of veteran exhibitors, Dave Friedman and Dan Sunny. The picture did no business at all. So.
Well, we never made a critic's picture. Now, they never gave us two thumbs up. At best, they would give us two middle fingers up. We were answering some, what was the, about the stage blood. At the time, of course, one of the problems with our stage blood was it seemed semi-permanent. So it had to be the last thing we shot before saying goodbye to the cast. Which was no problem. Retakes was something we never even heard of. That was not a possibility on our set. But as the gore film sub-industry matured, the tools available to us also matured. First, we had mortician's wax, so we could bury blood in what appeared to be a body, and when we punctured it close up, the blood would gush out, which helped us with a lot of hospital bills we would have had to face otherwise. And as these improvements came, it became also clear to us that we were nearing the end of the cycle that we had started. Because then the major companies said, as they always do when an independent shows success, how long has this been going on? We better get into the act. And in they came like the Hessian invaders, with equipment, with effects, with star names, with the electronic gear that with which we couldn't compete. And we felt, okay, fine, we've had a nice run. Which again shows how cloudy the crystal ball can be, because here we go again. And just today, I'm talking to people about a new movie called Grimm Fairy Tales, which has been on my plate here for about 2-3 years, and we may just make it this coming winter. Yes, sir.
It's so wonderful to have all four of you here.
I think so, too.
But there's one person who's not here, and I wondered if y'all could talk a little bit about Bill Kerwin.
Bill Kerwin, of course, was the consummate actor slash helper. He used the name Thomas Wood in the movies because of Screen Actors Guild situations. But Bill was always, he was a pitch-in type and a professional actor. That's what he did. Bill was in a bunch of pictures for us, and he was in a bunch of pictures for other people, too. And as he aged, he obviously switched from being a leading man into a character actor. He died, I think, 4 or 5 years ago. He had fallen on, I won't call them tough times, but it was not happy times for him. And he wasn't in good health. And he was living in a little place in Davie, Florida, which is a suburb of Fort Lauderdale. And a very sad thing to see him go, because if there were more Bill Kerwins, it'd be a lot easier to make movies.
Connie, can you tell me how you got started and how you met Herschel and got in Blood Feast?
I was working for Playboy and a bunny at the time. My playmate, Centerfold, was going to come out in 3 months. And I think they hired me because of that, maybe. I was
not a bad reason.
The good thing about Blood Feast and 2000 Maniacs is it really sparked and inspired me acting-wise. I went to New York and worked with some of the best directors and also great acting teachers, Strasberg. I mean, it really set me free. That last scene in Blood Feast where he was just trying to murder me and I was lying on a table and he was going to give me a good whack, but thank God my mother came in. And
mothers always get in the way of a good scene.
What was that line, Connie?
Oh dear, we'll have to have hamburgers.
Yeah, right.
Or hey, you're not going to sacrifice me on this altar, are you?
Right. Good for you.
Incidentally, I don't know if you folks know it, but Mal here, prior to Blood Feast and the picture before, which was called Scum of the Earth, he played a young tough. So the transition from being a young tough to being Fuad Ramsey, now that's the spectrum of acting.
I would say, obviously, coming from an old Southern family, 2000 Maniacs has a special residual effect for us, but I was wondering how the film did, what was the reaction nationally? I mean, that was done in the middle of both the Civil Rights Movement and the Civil War Centennial.
Well, from our point of view, yes, I think everybody in the industry knows 2000 Maniacs to this day is my personal favorite of all the movies I was involved in. At the time, we had no political agenda. We felt that this made sense in both directions because even though we called these people maniacs, we made it very clear they were atypical of 20th century people who lived down in the South. I'm not sure that's true, by the way. Nobody laughed at that one.
Well, Herschel has always had this, I'd almost say an obsession about things Southern. I think one of the reasons he and I got along is because I was born and reared in Alabama, and he just liked good old boys and rednecks, and it actually started that the idea came from a film and a play on Broadway called Rigadoon that I was telling Herschel about. And he said, what about a Southern town that comes to life after being massacred by the Yankees? I said, yeah, that might work. And from that, he wrote the script. But Herschel has always had this big love of all things Southern.
Oh, and I like hillbilly music, too. The story behind, well, the theme music on 2000 Maniacs. Dave and I always took many roles, and not out of any auteur complexes, because we didn't want to pay anybody. So we had this wonderful little musical group for 2000 Maniacs, and we got them all together in a little recording studio. Cast and crew had to be there to yell yee-haw on the theme music, and the musician showed up, and their lead singer, the thing begins, "There's a story you should know from 100 years ago." And he started to rehearse, "There's a story, wait a minute." I said, "Falsetto is not going to work here. There's got to be a little more macho than that." And really, because I knew, I'd written the words, so I knew them, and everybody said, "Come on, we want to go home. So it's my voice on that soundtrack. But the reason for all of that stuff, and the reason that oftentimes we will have fake names, I'm Lucky Pierre. Dave and I had a credit that says, "Lenses by Coca-Cola Bottling Company." It was because we weren't ego-driven. We were budget-driven. And I have always maintained that brains are a great substitute for dollars, but not everybody in Hollywood obviously subscribes to that. Just look at some of their products, which is, it's playable, but it's not entertaining. And our little touch of motion picture history is that we established a niche for a specific type of entertainment. And that entertainment not only exists, it flourishes. And we are grateful to all you guys for making that possible. Yes, ma'am. Oh.
If you remember, what was your muse to become a horror director out of anything that you could have done? What gave you that inspiration to become?
It beat standing in the unemployment line. We have been making other kinds of pictures, and that field, too, was becoming crowded. In fact, it was becoming crowded with people whose budgets were even lower than ours. But with that type of film, the image on the screen made no difference, and as Jimmy and I were talking about earlier, the title could change and it would be a different picture. They all looked the same. So the question was on the table for us, what kind of motion picture might there be that the major companies either would not make or could not make that exhibitors would show and people would go to see? And it was a very limited list. And today there is no such limit at all, because the line between independent and major company doesn't exist. And anybody with a video camera can and does make a feature. Probably half of you guys sitting here are in the process of making features, because it's not easier, but it's more available. Because the days of shooting only in 35 millimeter color are going quickly into eclipse. So we took advantage of a situation that existed then. What could we make? What kind of movies were there that people would play and go to see, but the major companies weren't making? And we just stumbled accidentally into that marvelous category. So it was half accidental, but certainly the intention was deliberate.
Mal, can you tell me how you got started and met Herschel and Dave? And
right. I have to, of course, thank Dave and Herschel for the opportunity to play in Blood Feast. And I think...
Wouldn't have been the same without you.
If I think back, when it came to auditioning for the film, I think Herschel didn't have me in mind for the lead. It was a smaller part. But I think because I did audition fairly well, he felt that I would be ideal for the lead of Blood Feast. And of course, it turned out very beneficial for me, because prior to that, I was a stage actor, professional stage actor, acting on stage for 5 years before I even made the first film, which of course was for Herschel. And the transition from stage to film is, I can't say severe, actually, it was easier for me to be in a film, because I've had the discipline of stage. And when you're on stage and playing in seven or eight different stage plays, you get a certain degree of discipline. And I think Herschel realized
yes.
that with me, it was very easy. I was very easy to direct.
Great novelty for me, by the way.
Yeah, because one of the other actors, of course, Bill Kerwin, who was an excellent actor, I looked up to him because he was excellent. And I kind of took his lead, so to speak, and it was easy to act with him because he was so professional and so good at what he did. And so it was really easy for me. Acting-wise, I've had many years of acting experience, and being a drama graduate in school, I felt that I could play pretty much any part, although playing the part of a psychopathic killer was a little bit strange for me, because all my parts were either comedy on stage.
But you told me you were a psychopathic killer.
Well, yeah,
but
I didn't know that at all. I played pretty much parts of comedy and just straight drama. So to play a part of a psychopathic killer was kind of weird, but I knew that I could do it. All I had to do was summon up the bad personality in me, and I knew I could do that. And it turned out very well. I never realized that the film itself would end up to be a cult film and become a classic, which it has. And as I say, with the opportunity to be in the film with people like Connie and Bill Kerwin and Greg Mosley, if you remember him,
he's in
the movie himself, and a few of the other actors in there. I was happy, never realizing that the film would be what it is. I remember that being a classic gore film, and so dramatically gory. Prior to that, there was never any blood shown in films. Even in the days of Humphrey Bogart or Jimmy Cagney, when somebody was shot, there was never any blood.
No, in fact, Blood Feast was the first movie in which people died with their eyes open.
Right. And also bled profusely. And
they're only actors, Mel.
Right, exactly. So this was a new era of acting, and it actually entered in. We started the trend.
Yeah.
And after that, everybody was doing it. And today it's a common thing to see the gore so graphically displayed in some of the films. So I'm very grateful for the opportunity to be in that and several other films, Scum of the Earth and a few of the other films that Herschel has directed. And I thank these gentlemen, and I continually thank him for the opportunity. Does anyone have any questions, right?
Do you often get recognized?
Yes, I do. As a matter of fact, I've made several personal appearances where theater owners see me, and when they were playing the movie, stopped me actually on the street and said, "Would you come in and make a personal appearance right in the theater?" And I did this in North Carolina. I did this in Florida. It was one of the places I did this up towards closer to New York. They asked me to come in and come up on stage and speak, which I did, and sign autographs. So, in fact, even at a restaurant one time, I was eating down in Miami, and one of the waiters came over and said, "Weren't you in that movie, Your Blood Feast?" I said, "Yes, I was." He says, "Quick, sign this napkin for me." So I autographed a napkin for him, and he was thrilled with it. He was thrilled. And I do get people to recognize me. In fact, I get mail today from people all over the country. They'll send me a letter, say, "Would you please sign this or autograph and send it back to me?" Which I do. So. I'm very gratified that people can still remember a film that was made so long ago. But it made an impression on everyone, and that was one of the reasons that I think that I'm grateful to have been in that film. I think that what Herschel had in mind was a John Carradine type of character, which I was not. So they had to make me look as gruesome as possible with the makeup, with the sallow complexion and the dark lines in the face and thick eyebrows and the gray in the hair. So it did vary. The gray did vary because it wasn't the same, obviously, in the same spot each time. But they tried to put it in the same spot. Yeah. But if you have a real critical eye, you could see there is.
Well, your question is, who was Mal Arnold's makeup artist? The answer is Mal Arnold. We had no control over what motion picture might play in the theater the week before our picture showed up. And that was before they had the film rating system. Every area had its own censor board to contend with. Our trick was to inveigle people to attend this movie and yet not be so outrageous that they wouldn't run the trailer, the coming attraction, which we always call the coming atrocity. And as some of you know, it says, "Ladies and gentlemen, you are about to see some scenes from the most unusual motion picture to ever play in this theater. We urgently recommend, if you have a heart condition, or if you are with a young and impressionable child, that you leave this auditorium for the next 90 seconds." Figuring, if that didn't keep them there, nothing would. But we wanted the legitimacy of the warning. That was the idea behind it. The idea of getting a picture opened on an independent level in those days was a formidable task. That's why Dave Freeman is today recognized as the genius who made that possible. Because a major company, even then, could run a television campaign nationally so that there was total awareness of what was going to happen, or it was coming. For us, on a market-by-market basis, we didn't have that luxury. Here's Harry Potter with 1,700 prints. 1,700 prints of the movie. One print was more than our budget. So we make light of it as we did then. We never lost our sense of humor about what we were doing, but neither did we lose our recognition of the posture we had to have in the world of motion picture exhibition. So that was the reason behind that.
Do you think it, the kind of stuff that you were doing would have made it easier for films of the later 60s, such as Bonnie and Clyde, to be much...
Absolutely. Without a question, the ground that we broke made it possible for others who followed up until today.
It's easier.
That wouldn't be there. Yes, sooner or later, just as sooner or later, someone would have discovered America after Columbus did it. But who knows when? We did it, and we have, we needn't necessarily say that with pride, but we certainly say it with certainty that these were groundbreaking movies and ground-shattering movies in which in some areas we were regarded with disgust. We had a mail campaign from San Diego. It just came flooding in, and every one of these letters referred to us as, how they found us, I don't know. You reckless men. And the reason we knew it was an organized campaign is because every letter spelled reckless, R-E-C-K-L-E-S-S.
W-R-E-C.
They left the W. W-R-E-C-K.
R-E-C-K.
Yeah, W-R-E-C-K. So as though we hadn't had a wreck instead of the actual spelling of reckless. So we knew it was organized, that we were able to generate organized opposition for a little movie like that. We knew we had something on our hands. Yeah,
it was a good enough movie, really, to have his own Showtime. It appeared on Showtime.
Oh, it's been on cable a number of times.
And not only that, but if you remember the movie Serial Mom with Kathleen Turner, in the movie she was watching Blood Feast on her TV in the movie, as part of the movie, and the scenes were on there. I said, my gosh, I didn't know that. I was watching the movie. I said, she's watching Blood Feast. I can't believe it. So it did get around.
It got around.
So for the type of movie that it was, and they were showing it on Showtime, I said, it has to be good. It has to be good.
How important were the DVDs to expanding your audience?
Gigantic. Because that legitimizes them beyond anything that anybody else could possibly do. Another reason why we are indebted, all four of us, to Jimmy Maslin and Mike Rainey.
Can I sum it up?
Sure, go ahead.
I think Herschel and I first met in 1958. Between 1959 and 1964, together we made 12 movies, 12 feature films. And all I can say is that it wasn't so much the money. We didn't know if they were going to work or not. But it was more fun than anything I have ever done in my 82 years of being on this earth. And it was so great. Herschel was the director and the camera person with that old Mitchell BNC that you had that weighed 6 tons. And I was the sound man with that old beat-up Ampex recorder. And between the two of us, as I say, we turned out 12 motion pictures that played in theaters and earned some money. But all I can say to you, if any of you ever get in the picture business or you're going to make a picture, go in and have some fun doing it, because that's what we did. And it's a pleasure to be here and talk to you all again. And thank you again for all of your interest in the things we've done.
Folks, thank you.
There's a story you should know from 100 years ago, and 100 years we've waited now to tell. Now the Yankees come along, and they'll listen to this song, and they'll quake in fear to hear this rebel yell.
And they'll quake in fear to hear this rebel yell. Yeah! Oh, the South's gonna rise again. Yeah! Oh, the South's gonna rise again.
Robert E. Lee broke his musket on his knee, and 1,000 pieces shattered on the ground. But he looked up then, and he gathered up his men, and from his lips there came an awful sound.
And from his lips there came an awful sound. Yeah! Oh, the South's gonna rise again. Yeah! Oh, the South's gonna rise again.
Stonewall took a gun and he made the Yankees run, but he took a fatal bullet in the chest. As he fell down dead, old Stonewall said, I'm a-giving you a dying man's request.
I'm a-giving you a dying man's request. Yeah! Oh, the South's gonna rise again. Yeah! Oh, the South's gonna rise again.
Stewart spurred his horse and the Yankees ran, of course, but there wasn't any powder for his guns. So he said to his boys, let's make a lot of noise and we'll charge again and make them Yankees run.
And we'll charge again and make them Yankees run. Yee-haw! Oh, the South's gonna rise again. Yee-haw! Oh, the South's gonna rise again.
Robert E. Lee broke his musket on his knee, and 1,000 pieces shattered on the ground. But he looked up then, and he gathered up his men, and from his lips there came an awful sound.
And from his lips there came an awful sound. Yeah! Oh, the South's gonna rise again. Yeah! Oh, the South's gonna rise again.
You've been listening to DVD Talk Radio. Find DVD Talk Radio online at dvdtalkradio.com.